This is the DMT One-to-One Show, episode 31, on the 16th of October 2013. An interview with Remy Harris, author of Music Tank's Easy Money, the definitive UK guide to funding music projects. This week's show is sponsored by media law firm Sheridans at sheridans.co.uk. It's a real pleasure to be here with Remy Harris, author of the Music Tank Funding Guide. So hi, Remy, and great to have you on the show. How's it going?
Hi, Andrea. How are you?
Great, thanks. And Remy heads the consultancy Start Projects and also has extensive experience in events management, having worked on the London 2012 Olympic opening ceremony, the Urban Classic project at the BBC Proms, and the You Are in Control Creative Conference in Iceland. So lots of experience there, and you've also worked on a lot of funding projects. So it's great to have you here and talk about this book. So first of all, you know, we're here to chat about the Easy Money Finance Guide you wrote, and this is a very dense document. So let's start with the broad strokes. What is this book all about?
It's basically a book about how the music industry has changed from being an industry where we had an internal funding model where we could go to other people in the same industry and get finance for developing new artists.
Yeah.
So I think everybody's really aware of that, and especially people that work in digital music and have seen all the changes going on in digital are aware of the disruption that there's been in the music industry. And one of the effects of that has been that people need to look outside of the music industry now in order to find finance to develop artists. Yeah. So just to give you an idea, when I first started working at AIM about 15 years ago now, at that time it was possible for people to go to distribution companies and get an advance still for advance sales of their CDs, and use that money to market and to record and to support their artists. Is not possible now. So it's really about how that change has happened, and then it goes straight into practical tips about the six key ways of getting music finance. So the six key sources: crowdfunding, grants, money from friends and family is a really important one for anyone that's bootstrapping a business, as you know. It looks at investment, it looks at debt finance, and it also looks at corporate sponsorship or commercial sponsorship as well. So it's a real practical guide, but it's based in this need.
So how did the project come about? So it must have taken a long time to write the book, and of course you drew from your experience, and I'm sure it was a long process of research as well. So how did that come about?
Sure. Well, I mean, I mentioned that I used to work at AIM, Association of Independent Music. I worked there for 10 years, and during that time, just by chance, really, that I was the person dealing with some of the finances, I became known as the funding person.
Yeah.
And I also did some fundraising, as I as you mentioned at the beginning, and raised money from public funding to fund some of AIM's projects. So I became like this expert, but I didn't really know a lot. And I just became more and more fascinated by the subject and more determined to answer the question, how do I raise money to fund my band or fund my artist putting an album out? And it's just a question for so many people in the music industry.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, I just started to campaign. So when I worked at UK Music as director of operations, we had a big campaign, which was to do with the access to finance in the terms of bank loans, a big kind of publicity campaign and a big piece of lobbying that went to the government. And you know, these things take a very long time to be realised. I realise people need the information now to be able to actually apply that to work that they're doing now. So you know, the idea came about. I talked to Music Tank about it, and they were really enthusiastic about the idea and really supported it, and have ended up publishing the book. So it's great.
That's awesome. That's great. And looking at how you talked about the evolution of how musicians have to go about funding a release, and I think that I was going to ask you first thing, how do you think the funding situation has changed over the last 10 years? Has it become easier for musicians to try and fund their recording directly?
It's become easier because it's become cheaper to make and distribute the music digitally, and there's so many great tools and resources out there to do that now. But at the same time, that has disrupted the revenue streams that were previously there for recorded music. So you know, that support from the mainstream industry has become a little bit more difficult to come by. I do say in the book that obviously, for example, major record labels, publishers, and in fact live music industry are still really, really important funders, biggest funders of new music. However, there's fewer big record companies to go to.
Yeah.
And so there's fewer doors to knock on if you're a developing artist.
Yeah.
And so that leads to the question, well, where else can you go to get money? That's really, I feel that's really the change that's happened, is there's not as many A&R people with that development budget as there used to be. And you know, you hear managers, or I have many friends that are managers, you know, talk about that all the time. It's extremely competitive out there.
Yeah.
And there's some great, you know, there's some great artists who don't have access to funding from that system.
Yeah.
So there's just this need there for them to have some alternative ways of funding what they do.
Absolutely. And it's also a case of a lot of musicians still don't think about the role of a label as the role of essentially like a bank with a better marketing system. But essentially, you know, the fact that labels have less money to spend on this type of development is essentially causes the fact that musicians have to go and look at alternative ways. And look at those alternative ways when you're looking at grants and the potential of public money coming into play, things like the PRS Foundation. Have those increased in reach and helpfulness towards musicians? And has the internet, for example, made it easier for musicians to access those resources, whereby maybe 10 years ago there were more the realm of fewer musicians that could actually get around finding all that information offline?
I think it's just become essential for musicians to take responsibility, really, and ownership for that side of things. There isn't really anybody there wanting to, you know, willing to take that on for a lot of us now. So
absolutely,
we have to take that on ourselves and take ownership of that. What I think's happened is that a lot of organisations have been in the space between, if we're talking about PRS Foundation and funding and so on,
yep,
have been in that space between the funding sector, if you want to call it that, and the commercial artists. So,
right.
I mean, historically, people will know that PRS Foundation was grew out of funding for classical music, and the same with Arts Council and other bodies.
Yeah.
And over time, there's been interest from those organisations and pressure from outside the organisations for them to change and become more open to all genres of popular music and
right,
not just the traditional music. So, you know, a lot of people have done work, including PRS Foundation and their staff and people that have been advising them to open up and do things in a way that is accessible, really.
Yeah.
So, for example, I talk in the book about their funding application process, where in the first step you submit music to them, and you submit a kind of short description, and then if you're eligible and they like what you do and it's up to a reasonable standard, then you go on to doing full applications. I think that's really fantastic.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good way of working when you're trying to give out that particular type of funding to musicians. I think it's a very friendly way of doing it, because these funding applications, as I talk about, can be very daunting. The language,
yeah,
that you need to use to communicate is sometimes tricky to master,
and quite dry as well for, you know, an artist.
Quite dry for an artist, and you know, it has to be really, questions have to be answered in a certain way that the funder requires.
Yeah.
You know, each investor or each funder has their own separate
way
and what they need out of the relationship. So it may be that they're a charitable trust who has particular needs, you know, they want to fund a particular kind of music or in a particular area.
Yeah.
And so it's about aligning yourself with them. And in a way, with the record companies, let's say in the old model, or the model that we're used to,
yeah,
you always had to do that as well. So in some ways, the needs are more aligned,
yeah,
between the artist and the record company. They're more in the same world. But every manager knows that sometimes, you know, the artist's interest and the record company's interest are not exactly the same.
Yeah.
And part of the job of the manager is to represent the artist within that setting. And so it's the same thing with all the other types of financial support as well. It's just about kind of aligning yourself to what they do.
To what they do. Yeah, yeah. And I think the book is great just because it gives you a really wide perspective on all the options that are out there. And I think one of the key things that artists have to do when they get to the stage where they're looking for funding is they have to decide what kind of funding they're going to get. And I think that also informs the path that they're going to take over the next 6 months to a year. So that decision is fundamental to their development as well, you know, whether they go the crowdfunded route or you know, the sponsorship or find grants for friends and family, that completely changes the way in which you're going to operate within the next, you know, 3 to 6 months. So that decision is key to their development, right?
Yeah, it's so challenging for artists, and I really sympathize with them, especially at the early stages of the career as well.
So the
book kind of talks about what is needed in terms of building relationships in whatever type of funding you decide to go down. It's really key. So the people that I talked to and the case studies in the book where people have had successful crowdfunding campaigns, for example, they were very, very honest about the amount of time and effort it took for them to run their campaign properly and be successful and get the thousands of pounds that they were looking for. And I think the same goes with whatever you do. You know, if it's sponsorship, it's very hard to get. You need to work on it and build relationships and also know that that's the way that you want to go, you know, the road that you want to go down. And I feel encouraged though by writing the book. I feel like it's doable. It's achievable. It's just like a question of, it's a question of focus.
Absolutely. And, you know, the funding stages are a very interesting concept as well. Like, you talk about how there are, you know, 5 funding stages that essentially are similar for whatever type of funding you're looking for, you know, developing the idea, assessing the idea, acquiring, delivering, and reporting on that particular project. So I think that's also a case of the bands looking at any single project that they take on of this kind as a business plan, essentially, and then develop it accordingly. Almost as if they were, you know, because they are a small business, so they have to behave as such. It's just that the mentality wasn't quite there before and has to be developed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've got some different thoughts about that, actually. I think it's really hard to, I think it's really hard to be an artist and also commercialize what you do as well and have that mindset. I do think that if you've got managers or even just another friend or another person there, they can be really useful kind of in giving a reality check and an objective view of what you're doing. And I think I do think it's very difficult. I think it's the new model that's kind of being pushed, and I'm always so suspicious of things that are being pushed. So I think the you know, like, the I talk about Jay-Z a little bit in the book, and I talk about how you know, this mythology and story has grown up around how he created his fortune and, you know, his empire, selling from the back of his car or, you know, whatever, just doing it all himself. And I kind of sometimes like a little bit suspicious of that. In that, I don't think it will work for everybody. You know, and some artists are not going to be able to run as their own business. It's a hard thing to do. Other people are going to feel much more comfortable taking the control into their own hands and running their own business than being with a big label, you know. So it's not right for everybody, but I think the idea of the book is to give the tools and the information so that if that's what you want to do, then you can go ahead and do that.
And do that. And you made a great point, because, you know, today sometimes it feels as if what we're saying in the industry is that if you're an artist that is not good or doesn't feel comfortable or is not interested in running the business side of things, then you're not going to make it. So, you know, sometimes that feels like that's the message just coming out there. But, you know, there are ways in which you can find help. And if you don't have an official manager, then there are ways to find friends or family that can help you with that side of things. And if music, that's what you want to do, you know, there's no reason why, if you're not business minded, you shouldn't be able to do that, even today, right?
Exactly. I mean, we're doing it. I think you may know, but we're doing a convention with Music Tank.
On the 22nd of October.
On the 22nd of October, and I'll be doing more talks as well. After that, I'll be at University of Warwick and hopefully in Birmingham in New Year as well. We're doing things like that as a way of helping the people who feel like it might be right for them to talk about business planning, to talk about how you write applications, to talk about investment and how that works. I was really interested to find a couple of companies who had got an investment, which I wasn't really expecting. I wasn't expecting to find that from relatively small amounts of money. So the convention is going to talk about all that and how you do it and who it's right for. hopefully people will find that really useful.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny how sometimes some things come back around. Like I read a piece on Eurythmic, actually. We're talking about how they got their Sweet Dreams album made thanks to a $5,000 bank loan that they used to buy equipment to get the recording done. And so, you know, there's examples of this that go all the way back to the 80s. So it's cool to see this kind of coming into the mainstream. And of course, it's going to be difficult even today for a band to go to a bank and ask for this kind of money. But to know that there are institutions and opportunities for them to have a vision and try and get that vision accomplished, even if they don't have the fund themselves, that's a fantastic opportunity for them, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm really an avid reader of historical stuff and the rock biographies and things, and I refer to some of the cases in the book. A great book about the history of the independent labels, which is published by Cherry Red. It may be called History of Independent Labels, actually. I have to check.
I have to check that out.
It's a really great book, and it talks about labels like Rough Trade and Beggar's Banquet, and you know how they started out, and it talks about how they were financed, and it talks about loans from parents, and it talks about you know, advances from and deal, licensing deals with major labels and amounts, and you know how those organizations in the 70s working independently grew up, you know, and how they made it work. And it is interesting actually that both of them started out as not just as labels, but as a record shop in one case and as a mobile DJ business and then record shop in the other case. You know, they were very close to the customer, if you like, and they were kind of
very cool.
You know, working with the record buying public and understanding what they want and everything. But I mean, they're just fascinating histories, actually, to see how they were developed. And it kind of gives me hope that actually people can come up with new ways of doing things now. I think most of those people will say that it's probably tougher now.
Yeah.
for people starting up now. But you know, there's still a lot of fantastic music and really great entrepreneurs in this area as well, so it gives me kind of hope that people will continue to kind of come up with new things and innovate.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's a fantastic read. I would recommend people to go and check out musictank.co.uk, where you're going to find links to the ebook. You're going to find links to the Easy Money Convention, which is happening on October the 22nd. So if you are in London, I would recommend you go on musictank.co.uk and check it out if it's something that you'd like to attend. I'm sure you get lots of great information out of it. And Remy, it was a real pleasure having you on the show, and it was a pleasure reading your ebook as well.
Thank you very much. And one other thing I should say, anyone sure. that goes into musictank.co.uk can download the first chapter for free.
Perfect.
As well, so they can try before they buy.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for listening to this week's DMT 1-to-1. Now a short information piece recorded with this week's sponsors, media law firm Sheridans at sheridans.co.uk. It's great to be here with Tahir Bashir with another segment on digital service providers. So hi, Tahir, and great to have you on.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So we're going to talk about terms today, terms between digital service providers and rights holders. So first of all, let's tackle one of the more common issues that service providers encounter when doing a deal with especially a bigger potential partner, but also smaller ones, which is MFN, which is a most favored nation. So how do you tackle that, and what's the best way to really deal with that inevitable roadblock that comes up pretty much every time you try and do a deal?
Yeah, so just to explain to the viewers and listeners, MFN clauses are most favored nations clauses, which effectively means that whatever you agree in this particular deal with your content provider, if you agree something better with another content provider, that then comes into this deal. You know, for me, they're horrible clauses. I've seen businesses actually go under as a result of MFN clauses, because when it comes to the audit stage, the content owner audits, sees that somebody else got better terms, and then insists on those, and the company doesn't have it because they've already paid the monies out. Yeah. So for me, it's lazy negotiation. You know, a rights owner should know the value of their rights at this stage, but inevitably, you know, there are times when you can't get around them and they insist on them. So what you need to do in those scenarios is just make sure that you've got a good lawyer who is carving the actual wording so as not to make it too too wide and for it to be very specific as to what it actually attaches to.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the riskier factors in terms of, do you think like rates, for example, are a precedent that can be risky for the startups, or are there other particular nitty-gritty bits that can be uncomfortable for them?
I mean, there's lots of things that can be uncomfortable. Rates are obviously, you know, the commercial, you know, this is what we're paying out. But
territoriality as well.
Yeah, territories are important. The way that you use the rights, bundling deals, which is, you know, all, you know, many see as Shangri-La at this moment in time. You know, being able to work white labeling services, all these types of terms tend to be tricky. But, you know, particularly when you've got a service which is trying something different,
yeah,
then ultimately what you want to try and encourage the rights owner is, well, let's try this out on a trial period at least. We're not setting a precedent. Let us have a go. We will track what we do. And I think tracking is really important from a DSCP's perspective, because if you can track your usage, track your revenue, track your return, track the kind of number of eyeballs you're getting on your service, this is really good data, which then can justify your position moving forwards when you're negotiating for the next element.
That's great. Thank you very much, and until the next segment.